Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We got a little jobs and wages today. We've got a television story. And there will be blood. Or at least the business thereof. We're that kind of show, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 13th of January today, and we're going to start by looping back to last Friday and the December unemployment report. It was pretty good, if you'll recall. A 250,000 new jobs in this economy to end the year. The only blemish, really, was a drop in hourly wages. That's been the case throughout this recovery, paychecks basically being stuck for years and years. The headline news of this Tuesday for us doesn't really change that writ large, but it does offer some small glimmer of hope. Aetna, the giant health insurance company, is going to raise its minimum wage and increase health care benefits for some of its low-income workers. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with that story.
Employers usually don't decide to raise wages because the wage fairy visited them in their sleep and they happened to wake up in a good mood.
Aetna's U.S. minimum hourly base wage will be increased to $16 an hour.
That's spokesperson Cynthia Michener. Usually employers raise wages because they have to, because there's a shortage of employees. That's not exactly Aetna's reason.
No, as the healthcare industry moves to a consumer industry, Aetna is investing in the employees who interact with our customers every day.
This is a strategy to reduce turnover, improve morale, and upgrade customer service in a healthcare industry that's changing rapidly.
Those service jobs have a very high turnover rate, and we are making an investment to reduce that.
So it's not necessarily a sign that low-wage workers everywhere else are going to get a raise. But when we do start to see more frequent across-the-board wage increases, it'll look a little bit like what Aetna's doing, says Princeton economist Orly Ashenfelter.
Across-the-board wage increases are more likely to happen in standardized job positions.
Like Aetna's call center jobs or other low-wage jobs where everyone is doing the same thing. In a corporate environment, you can get away with paying the new guy more because people won't know about it.
It's difficult to pay crew members in a McDonald's vastly different wage rates because they all know that the other person is doing the same thing.
We aren't seeing wage increases yet, though. Gary Bertless is with the Brookings Institution.
Nationwide, it does not appear that people in the bottom half of the wage distribution are seeing faster gains than anyone else.
And when you factor in inflation, wage increases have been a zero for the past 4 years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Not that it is necessarily any of my business, but how are those resolutions coming anyway? Maybe you're still hitting the gym because you want to, of course, but maybe also perhaps because your boss is sweetening the pot through a workplace wellness program, incentives, or, in fact, financial penalties. But as those incentive programs get more popular, in part because of the Affordable Care Act, how well do you suppose do they actually work? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story from the Health Desk at WHYY.
How do you slow down the freight train that is annual health care cost increases? Prudential Financial Chief Medical Officer Dr. Andrew Crichton says one of the few options is worker wellness programs.
People see this as a possible solution, not the only solution, but it could help.
Wellness programs are expected to double this year to nearly half of the nation's largest employers. That's according to Towers Watson. There's just one thing, says Johns Hopkins' Ron Getzel.
The latest research done showed that only about 7% of U.S. employers have comprehensive, well-designed, well-implemented health promotion programs. So that's certainly not enough.
Getzel's a proponent of these programs when done right. But even he agrees this $6 billion industry produces some programs that do little to improve health or save much money. So why then are employers flocking to something without much reliable data?
We suspect that companies are making money on them. Otherwise, they wouldn't make plans to increase the program.
Jill Horwitz is a law professor at UCLA. Horwitz says studies show for every dollar a company invests, it's getting $3.27 in return. She believes that happens because employers can cost shift to their workers who face penalties for not buying into the wellness program or fail to meet health goals.
Now, your job is not just doing the data entry. Your job is doing the data entry and getting a health care screening and losing weight.
Horwitz says several legal cases are challenging these sorts of practices. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda, y'all. Pretty much sums up Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Thanks to the fracking revolution we've got going in this country, one of the most common substances on the planet has become a much sought-after commodity. Sand is now a $10 billion industry, and demand has gotten so high, there have been times that oil and gas producers haven't been able to get enough of it. And even with drilling expected to taper off somewhat over the next year, low oil prices and all that, you've seen the stories, the question with sand is whether demand will stay the same or go up. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the first of two stories.
On a square of clay and gravel, about 40 miles north of downtown Denver, Joel Fox's colleagues are starting a frack on an oil well. That means they're about to pump sand and water down the hole to shatter the shale rock below. Fox runs fracking for a $9 billion oil and gas company called Encana.
So once they start the sand, you'll see it come out of that hopper.
The hopper is connected to a Sand King, what looks like a giant purple dumpster, 40 feet long, one end tilted up in the air. Oh, and here we go.
You can see the sand. He's starting to bring the sand into the blender right there to the end of it.
The blender mixes the sand with water. Then they get pumped into the well together. Fox's colleague Stacy Mitchell interrupts with a tap on the shoulder.
Got a truck coming in. He'll be backing in. We probably ought to move out of the way.
The truck has a partial refill for the Sand King.
He hauls approximately 50,000 pounds of sand off that truck.
Over the next hour or so, the Sand King will dump about four times that much sand into the blender. Fox explains just what the sand and water do in the well.
So the water provides the force.
Like 5,000 pounds per square inch.
To crack the rock open.
The water makes tiny cracks, flows into them, and brings the sand with it.
And then when I flow the well back.
Meaning pull the water back out.
I leave the sand in the fractures.
And the sand keeps these tiny little fractures propped open so Fox's colleagues can suck the oil out through them. They'll repeat this process 20 times for a single well.
So what is that? 2,000 tons in a well. And then we got seven wells.
That's seven wells clustered together just on this one site north of Denver. Multiply that out by more than 20,000 wells drilled in a year, according to oil and gas consultancy PacWest, more than 100 billion pounds, making frac sand a $10 billion industry. Several frac sand companies have gone public. Analyst Brandon DeBell follows them for William Blair & Company. He thinks those big companies will win over time because they can handle the logistics. Think FedEx and UPS.
When overnight delivery started, you had a whole bunch of companies doing overnight delivery. And the reason there's two is because it's really difficult to get a package from point A to point B in a very short amount of time, no matter where point A or point B is, and no matter how big or small that package is.
And delivering packages on time is a big part of what sand companies do. The packages are 25-ton truckloads. Joel Fox will use 560 truckloads of sand at these wells over the course of just a couple weeks. And if the trucks don't show up on time, then the dozens of people working here, they sit around waiting. Also, the equipment, the Sand Kings, the 10 truck-sized pumps, and everything else. According to PacWest, transportation can be about two-thirds of the price that operators like Fox pay for sand. And here's the other thing. Fox uses sand conservatively. Brandon DeBell describes what other producers have been finding.
Shoving a lot of sand down into each frack generates a lot more oil production.
Some companies now put two to five times as much sand into each well. Sand's expensive, but it's a small part of the total cost.
So they're doing the same days on drill and they're using the same equipment, but they're putting more sand in and they're going to get more oil out.
That's why DeBell thinks it's possible that even with low oil prices expected to reduce the number of wells fracked next year, the demand for sand could increase. And at least up to now, supply has been a bigger concern.
You know, people think of sand and you go to the beach and you pick it up and it's, you go to Saudi Arabia, there's a lot of sand. Well, the sand's different. You know, it's only in a couple of places.
The best sand for fracking is called Northern White. It comes from Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, and especially Wisconsin. And the rush to grab it has turned some rural areas inside out. In the town of Meade, Colorado, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Dan goes to Wisconsin to find the source of all that sand that fracking needs. Hot on the heels of its big night at the Golden Globes, Amazon announced today it has snagged one of Hollywood's biggest names. Woody Allen is going to do his first television series ever for Amazon's streaming video service. Allen's small screen inexperience is kind of okay, though, because the nature of television itself is changing. Between Amazon and Netflix, the battle of the streaming giants is on. And Nova Sapphire reports that Hollywood may actually be one of the big winners.
Here's how Woody Allen characterized his new Amazon deal, and I quote, "I have no ideas, and I'm not sure where to begin." Even so, Amazon gave him a full season order, and that right there is a sign of how competitive streaming TV has become.
The dynamics have changed rapidly in the last several years.
Steve Ennen is president of the entertainment research firm Centris.
That means the consumer has greater ability to find quality content of their choosing through digital distribution, and it's starting to show in the numbers.
A couple of those numbers, 11. That's how many new or returning original series Netflix will release this year. 100 million. That's how much Amazon spent on original content in just one quarter of last year.
That's part of the mission of these types of companies. Investment in good original content has a lot of value for them.
And that investment has been paying off, says Andrew Wallenstein, an editor with Variety.
It was just 3 or 4 years ago where the notion of getting the kind of quality entertainment you might get from broadcast and cable on the internet was really almost laughable.
Wallenstein says before, streaming services relied mainly on offering older seasons of programming from cable and network TV. They still rely on a lot of reruns, but networks are starting to reconsider that arrangement as their ratings drop.
They're making money from Netflix, good money, by licensing their shows, but if it hurts their own network ratings, you may see a dramatic pullback at some point.
Wallenstein says another incentive for streaming services to create original programming is to separate them from the competition. Netflix has already established its cred with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. And Amazon now has 2 Golden Globes and a big dose of buzz for its series Transparent.
Dad is a woman.
Does Mom know?
Of course I know that. You think I'm a dummy?
Amazon's starting to come up with content that rivals Netflix. Amazon has just about as many exclusives.
Analyst Michael Pachter of Wedbush Securities says the competition for high-quality shows could set off a bidding war in Hollywood. With more stars in the mix, writers, directors, and actors could be seeing bigger paydays.
Amazon very much wants to cut into the Netflix market share, and Amazon has a much bigger checkbook.
Ultimately, says Pachter, that could mean everyone in the entertainment game could be paying more for content. I'm Nova Sapphire for Marketplace.
Coming up, the most important metric in tech.
Someone went to your site, used your service, played with your app once a month.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a whiplash kind of day on Wall Street. The market shot up at the opening bell. They jetted south and then almost recovered. The Dow Industrials ended down 27 points, a tenth of 1%, 17,613. The NASDAQ off 3 points, less than a tenth percent, finished at 4,661. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.25%, closed in 2023. You might think being considered too big to fail or systemically important would be a good thing, but no. Coming out of the financial crisis a couple of years ago, for banks, it means more federal regulation. MetLife was recently the first insurance company deemed so big that it is too big to fail. Today, MetLife said it would be the first company to challenge that designation in court. Shares down 1.2%. A couple of tech companies managed some gains. Amazon up 1.1%, Google up 0.9%, Apple up 0.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Did everything you wanted turn up under the tree? The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for December. The Federal Reserve issues its Beige Book Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, the first one of the year. And tonight, when you lay out your clothes, be sure to set out something for your dog or cat. Tomorrow is Dress Up Your Pet Day. Sorry, furry friends. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The president's nominee for the number 3 job at the Treasury Department, Antonio Weiss, has taken his name out of consideration after a confirmation fight led by Senate Democrats. But if you somehow think this means Weiss won't serve in the Treasury Department, That would not be correct. He will be a counselor to Secretary Jacob Lew, an advisor. It's an arrangement that's become more common as nominees either can't get confirmed or don't want to go through the confirmation rigmarole in the first place. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at the rise of the government advisor industry.
So what's the difference, really, between an advisor and someone who's been confirmed? Does the advisor have the same amount of power without the pain of confirmation? Depends who you ask. A former Undersecretary of Commerce, like Robert Shapiro, will tell you an advisor doesn't have staff and the formal trappings of power.
And he's not part of the established task forces in the White House.
Shapiro says advisors don't have the legal authority of someone who's been confirmed. But advisors who are close to a secretary or president can be quite influential, especially if everybody knows they're close to power. Jack Pitney teaches government at Claremont McKenna College.
A lot just depends on the individual relationship and the reputation of that person in the Washington community. The reputation for power is power.
All those powerful people aren't cheap. Paul Light teaches public service at NYU. He estimates that President Obama has 1,500 to 2,000 advisors. Light says all those bodies can cause inefficiency.
Well, it's like the childhood game of telephone, you know, where you tell a secret to the person next to you, and that person passes it on, and eventually it gets distorted or dropped.
And Light says whoever's responsible for the drop or distortion doesn't get in trouble. There's little accountability for advisors. Congress can't collar them and call them on the carpet the way they could with someone whose nomination they'd approved. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today's the day, I guess, for stories on commodities that you don't usually think of as commodities. Sand from Dan Weissman a bit earlier. Now, blood. Because, as it turns out, this is a bloodthirsty country. More than 12 million pints of blood and blood products are used every year in the United States. And with that high demand and necessarily limited supply come challenges and opportunities. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports now on the business of blood.
At a level one trauma center, blood comes at a price.
We spend just under $4 million a year on blood products.
Mike Dossi is with John Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth. He pays more than $200 per pint of blood. Across the country, prices fluctuate wildly from $170 to $300, and product can go bad within days. That makes managing a blood supply much more complex than managing, say, morphine or pain pills.
It's not like if you run out of milk, you're fine. We'll just go without milk. But if you run out with blood, you know, there are lives at risk. So the stakes are very high.
That's Chris Godfrey. He wants to make it easier and cheaper for hospitals to quickly fine-tune their supply of the red gold. The problem, he says, is most hospitals rely on an inefficient system anchored by regional blood centers, meaning blood, well, it isn't flowing freely across the country.
So I may have an abundance of supply in Des Moines, which means it's wasting because it's got a very short shelf life, relatively speaking, while in Houston they're delaying procedures or people might be at risk because they can't effectively access those blood products.
That's why Godfrey started BloodBuy. It's a sort of price line for blood products, connecting supply with demand in a multi-billion dollar industry.
You have blood centers on the supply side and hospitals on the demand side. So we act as kind of a technology backbone that sits in between them and connects everybody.
Like Priceline, BloodBuy uses a series of matching algorithms to pair what a hospital is willing to pay with what's available. For example, a medical center might place an order for 100 pints of O-positive blood at no more than $200 a unit. Once the best match is identified, a blood center ships the order off. So far, there are users in six states. And in a pilot program, BloodBuy's technology saved Texas Medical Center in Houston more than 20% on blood expenditures. Still, Dossi with John Peter Smith Hospital says there are risks to the Priceline model.
But it might also affect your buying power with your current vendors that you have if you're using less of their products and going somewhere else.
Maintaining a good relationship with the blood bank in town is crucial, he says, when there's unexpected trauma.
You could have, a 10-car pileup out on the interstate and need those products swiftly, and having that relationship with our vendor is also key to getting those products here when you need them.
Both Dossie and Blood Buys Godfrey hope easier access to prices and inventory for hospitals will help even out supply and demand, so blood can, yes, circulate better. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Twitter bucked the downdrafts on Wall Street today. Shares picked up 0.7% or so, about $40 apiece at the close in New York. Dick Costolo, the CEO of the 140-character social network, has sold $25 million worth of company stock since November amid rumors that some of Twitter's big investors aren't all that pleased with the company's numbers. Not strictly numbers from the bottom line, though. It's the numbers that measure how you and I and everybody else are hanging out on Twitter and elsewhere online. Ben Johnson is here to explain. He's the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
All right, help me out here, man. Why do you want to talk about my Twitter feed?
Well, you know, it's not just your Twitter feed,
okay,
and your Twitter
right,
habits.
Everybody's.
So I want to talk about this metric that's always used in the tech world, your monthly active users.
Okay.
Or MAUs, as they're called.
And not this, the chairman this is, variety, but that's a whole different thing.
Not the chairman. So this is an important number because if you're, for instance, a company like Uber, which is right now valued at over $40 billion, yeah, investors are really, really looking at this number, this monthly active user number, which means someone went to your site, used your service, played with your app once a month, mm-hmm, at the very least. But here's the problem, Kai.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really simple metric that people are throwing millions of dollars around at.
Hmm.
And it, in some ways, is kind of a false metric.
All right. Explain to me how it's false. I mean, I get that it's one indicator in a broad ecosystem, but how is this one not a good one?
It's too simplistic. It's just basically someone came to your site and did something once, and then they did it the next month, and then they did it the next month, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's this argument happening within the tech community right now, and one of the pieces of news recently that came out was that Instagram has 300 million users,
yeah,
which is more than Twitter, which has, I don't know, 285 million users and change,
yeah,
right? The argument being there that basically Instagram is more valuable than Twitter. But a lot of people are saying, look, monthly active user isn't the end-all be-all. It's maybe one little metric, but we actually need to think about the amount of time that users right, are spending it's these social networks.
It's the whole quality time thing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Quality versus okay, quantity. And so I talked to one guy this week on Marketplace Tech. His name is Evan Williams. Mm-hmm. He's a Twitter founder, and he had this to say about time spent.
You can land on a website and stay for 3 seconds, or you can land there and read something for 5 or 10 minutes. And when you talk about the dimension of people who stop by as the only thing you talk about, what value are you measuring either to the people or to the company?
Right. And Ev Williams, as you said, is a co-founder of Twitter. He used to be the CEO,
yeah,
of that company, so one would imagine he knows whereof he speaks. But isn't the internet's all about metrics?
It is all about metrics. And this is, I think, what's happening that's really interesting, Kai. We're seeing this huge fight among tech companies and advertisers for a place on our mobile devices, right?
Right.
It's tough. The screen is smaller. You know, it's much more fragmented. But in some ways, that could be a good thing. The companies that will win out in this world are could be companies that are basically looking for niche areas, looking for smaller groups. The next generation of advertisers isn't going to be buying ads for the Super Bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be buying ads for curling equipment for the curling championships, right? And I think in the next few years, we're going to see the things we do on our phone really, really fragment and go niche. And we're going to see advertisers actually start to use the data that they're collecting on us all
mm-hmm.
the time and use that to create ads that are actually useful to us. And everybody's going to make a ton of money.
And wouldn't that be something if the ads are useful to us? Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today to end somewhat where we started with the American labor market. There are or were, I suppose you ought to say, as of the end of November, 4.972 million open jobs in this economy. That's more than there have been in 14 years. It's a Labor Department number and is taken by many, including one Janet Yellen, of whom you might have heard, as a good sign for the overall economy. It's called JOLTS, by the way. Look it up. It's a good little number. All right, we're done. Today, the Dow off 27 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ down 3 points, less than a tenth percent. The S&P 500 surrendered 5 points. That is a quarter of 1%. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Lindsay Thomas are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.